702 Weekend Breakfast with Refilwe Mpakanyane. Live, online,
smartphones,
DSTV channel 856
and 92.7 and 106 FM.
It is 6 minutes past eight. Thank you so much to Sifiso Zulu and the EWN team for that update. And time right now for our profile interview. This is what we do every Sunday between 8 and 9. Talk to an interesting person and individual. Someone who has inspired us, who is interesting. Someone who's making great strides in that field. Just a person to know, essentially. You know, let's bookmark this person. And that's what we're doing today with Dr. Kopano Mabaso. She's a founder of the Zero Stunting Initiative, but she's much more than that. Just 2 weeks ago, she was honored at the 2019 Health Excellence Emerging Leader Award at the 2019 SA Health Excellence Awards. And we met her back in 2007. When she wrote her first novel, Coconut, and she was at the time studying towards her medical degree as well, and she's since done many, many other things. And it's a pleasure to have you here in studio, Kopano. Thanks so much for your time. Definitely.
Thank you for having me.
Are you well?
Yes, I am.
Looking still like that fresh-faced 21-year-old that we first in 2007. Kopano, you know, you've really done so much at a young age. You're a medical doctor, you're an author, and you're a mother as well, which is an important adjective that you use on your own website as well to describe yourself. If I can ask, how has the motherhood journey changed things,
sure,
if at all?
Yeah.
Or is this, you know, you just, have you taken it all in your stride?
Your goodness. It has. I mean, I think it's definitely kept my feet firmly grounded. I've got a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. So I mean, I think it's given me a sense of, I suppose, greater purpose, I think. I mean, and also just being very aware of how I model what being a responsible citizen is, what being a loving parent is, what being a loving family member is. So, you know, they watch everything. Nothing is lost
on
them.
Sponges.
Yeah. So it's been great. It's been hard work. I mean, goodness, lots of sleepless nights, but yeah, such a joy. What do they say? The days are long, but the season is short. So we're trying to enjoy every aspect of it.
The days are long, but the season is short. As a, you know, when we were first introduced you back in 2007 with the publication of Coconut, so much was made of the fact that you wrote this book whilst you were studying towards your medical degree. But I think if one thinks of the British neurologist and historian of science, Oliver Sacks, right? The idea that one's profession can be one's only passion, right? Or even talent, is clearly a false one. How did you discover your own talent of writing novels and novels that, you know, were received, very well received amongst the public at large and critics?
Yeah, I mean, I still look back and think, gosh, I got so lucky. I didn't expect that at all. I've always read. I've always been a homebody, so really enjoyed reading. And I suppose writing is a natural extension of that, or at least it was for me. So Coconut, I mean, it was never the plan. I never sort of planned to be an author. I definitely wanted a career in medicine, and reading and writing was a hobby, and I didn't think anybody would read it. So I think I was, really pleased, humbled by how Coconut was well received and continues to be so many years later. I mean, I was surprised recently to, you know, see translations in other languages. So it's been incredible, and I'm proud of that 21-year-old self who had the courage to put her work out there, not knowing how it would be received.
And how many other languages has it been translated to? Just name a few.
Yeah, I mean, I think, goodness, Svenska, Spanish, Italian, Dutch. I would love local languages. This has been my biggest bugbear. But yeah, I mean, across the 3 novels, they've been translated into over 12 languages, which is, it's incredible for me because, you know, you write these things in your room as a young person, not thinking that anybody but your family members will read it. And then to think it's been, you know, across the world kind of people in many different cultures reading it is, an absolute privilege.
I mean, it has, I think, been a huge it's been a huge indicator of the kind of impact that you can make unwittingly, or without planning to do so. But I mean, that book, you won yourself a European Literary Award. You're the joint winner of the Wole Soyinka Prize for Literature in Africa in 2010. That was much later on. But, you know, you went on to write two more books, Spilt Milk, as well as Period Pain. If we are to draw a sort of through line, Kopano, and we'll talk medicine. Of course, we'll talk Grow Great, yes. You know, and where you are presently.
Yeah.
But if you're to draw a through line in your writing, what is your abiding theme that you're either working out, that you're thrashing out, and that you want to resolve? Not that there's, you know, any real resolution of issues in life or even in literature.
Sure, that's such a great question. It's I mean, maybe the growing pains of a new nation at a very individual level, because I think often we think about our South Africa at the macroscopic level, but we live it at the bedside, which is what Period Pain's about, you know, a failing health system and how it affects us as women and as individuals, Spilt Milk, young people, and I suppose coconut identity. So I think it is kind of becoming the South Africa that, at least when I remember being a young person, kind of my parents holding me in front of the TV watching Mandela released and saying, you know, you guys are going to have such an amazing future, and how that's panned out in both positive and negative ways. And so I suppose it's both kind of my reflections on the South Africa that we hoped we'd have and haven't quite had, but also just an authentic stories about being black, female, and young, and what that's all about and the challenges that come with that.
I mean, it's so interesting the worlds that you've constructed as well, where you've, you know, centered your protagonists and foregrounded them in such a matter-of-fact ways, you know, that of course your story matters, that of course you're going to create an academy in Spilt Milk for young black gifted children, you know, and we will teach in Setswana, and we'll, you know, we'll embrace our indigenous languages, and treat the way we are, you know, in a very matter-of-fact way, which takes away all of the explaining, the constant explaining and translating our own lived experiences, absolutely. You know. What was that process like? Was it a you know, conscious decision or conscious, you know, taking off of that kind of burden and saying, I'm just going to put this down and write this way?
Yeah.
Or did it come quite naturally?
Yeah, you're asking difficult questions.
Well, you're the one who's written three books and,
I mean, I suppose in retrospect, one can, I suppose, draw, but a lot of it is subconscious and not deliberate. I mean, I think Spilt Milk was hard because Coconut took me aback. Coconut, I wrote it like kind of in a vacuum, not even expecting an audience, no audience in mind. And then Spilt Milk was like, gosh, how do I match that? Right. And so I had to try very hard not to imagine an audience. And so a lot of it was my own anger, disappointment, frustration, but also the question of what do we do with all of that, right? What do we do with all that rage and frustration? And and then through the eyes of young people, through children who actually just want to play and belong and have fun, and how we burden them with our the squinch, you know, I don't know what the English word for that is.
Grudges. Squinchy. I love it.
I mean, a lot of it is not, I must say, I don't have a very sort of academic approach to writing. It is a lot of emotion and working, and that's why it takes me so long. But I suppose looking back, it's great not to have to explain why we just want, you know, things to be the way that we want to feel like the world we live in and our surroundings validate who we are as black South Africans, and then we don't have to explain why that's important. And I think in some respects Spilt Milk was trying to claim an aspect of that.
If you've are a fan of, you've read Kopano's books, any of them, and, you know, tracked her trajectory and perhaps even in the medical space as well, because obviously I come to you and approach you from the sort of literature and literary perspective, but, you know, I don't necessarily, whilst I can appreciate the work that you do, I don't have a real feel for it and can only imagine, you know, number one, the hard work that has taken to get to this point, and that the hard work that continues continues to go into being at this point. So if you want to, you know, call in and either speak to Kopano or send a message, send us an SMS on 31702. Otherwise, you can give us a call on 011-883-0702. I am in conversation today on the profile interview with Dr. Kopano Madwa Mabaso, and she's a medical doctor. She is a novelist, and she is a, can we add philanthropist to that label? Because you've done a lot of your work now, and even whilst you're studying, centered around helping people outside of, you know, outside of medicine, outside, you know, right beyond the writing, but in a more philanthropic bent. Are you comfortable with that term?
Goodness, it makes me sound like I've got money, which I don't have.
I suppose, yeah, I suppose philanthropy, okay. Means yeah, you've got millions to disperse.
To disperse, no.
And, yeah, and pretty soon you'll be holding a press conference telling us how many billions you're getting rid of by 2031 or something.
Yeah, yeah, no, I mean, I do recognize that, you know, we did grow up with certain privileges that were not necessarily commonplace in South Africa, and the great responsibility that comes with. I think we, at least my parents, kind of never made sure that that was never lost on us, that the great sacrifice in terms of our education and our upbringing. And so I have always cared, I suppose, and wanted to contribute, but also that, yeah, I mean, we're not going to achieve this Africa we want if there's only a couple of us who are benefiting from sort of, you know, the developed South Africa we have, and that if we really do want a South Africa that is globally competitive, that our children have equal opportunity, that we also need to do our bit. Yeah, so I think that's what my sort of side NGO stuff has been about, but not because I'm sort of loaded with millions to give away.
Okay, well, let's work on another adjective. Somebody sent me a text message, 31702. So essentially that, as a medical student, as if you had, you probably weren't doing enough, right? To take up all your time, not studying medicine. You founded, co-founded REMS, the Waiting Room Education by medical students. What was that? And what need were you trying to fill at that point?
Yeah. So, I mean, so I remember as like a first, second year, we used to participate in these mobile clinics. And we'd go into communities and, you know, you'd see our people essentially, you know, Bomama having left a job at maybe as a teller or as a domestic worker and only being able to access healthcare in the evenings. And these waiting rooms were packed. And there we were not really being able to add much value clinically because ourselves were still training. But we had a little bit of information. And so, and many of us had other talents. You know, we did drama in high school. We sang. We did all sorts of things. And so waiting room education was recognizing that a lot of the social ills that we see sometimes is a mismatch information or misinformation, and that if we empower and equip people with information to take care well of
them. And how did you do that?
So we did plays, skits, quizzes in waiting rooms, and it was lots of fun, but just a way to kind of interact with communities to kill time, but also to just empower people as well and ourselves. I mean, I think we often had to study quite hard to actually get the right information.
And where was REMS active?
So we partnered with an organization called Shoko at GCT, and it ran mobile clinics in all sorts of townships. So Khayelitsha, Philippi, Browns Farm, and these clinics would literally dock in communities and people would come, but they would sit in waiting rooms waiting for help. Yeah. So it was, I guess an opportune moment to kind of use the little information we had to share with communities and then engage with them. So we talked about contraception, STI, so things that are a little bit taboo, but, you know, through a little bit of a play or a quiz or a game show that we set up in those clinics, we could kind of unpack these topics. So it was lots of fun. I think the beginnings of trying to think, I think at least for me, it was the beginning of what would become a public health career, that I recognized that people were getting sick from things that were preventable.
Absolutely.
And just, you know, often in health systems, there was just no time or capacity to educate people. And so this was the beginnings of trying to do that.
Yeah. I mean, that's really, really interesting stuff, Kopano. You know, after that period, you, of course, go on to, you are a Rhodes Scholar, an alumnus of the University of Oxford, where you gained both your master's and DPhil, where you gained your master's and your DPhil in public health. Why study that, for instance, the continuation of the work that started at REMS, the continuation of a more targeted way of tackling all these things that essentially are preventable?
Yeah. I mean, a common sort of metaphor that's used in public health is you're standing along a stream and you're seeing bodies and you keep pulling them out, but they keep coming. Mm-hmm. And so I've always wanted to know, like, what is happening at the top of this hill? Like, why are these bodies falling into the water? And I think as an intern, I just got incredibly frustrated readmitting the same babies. You know, you discharge them, you give them medication, they come back. And it's because of social circumstances, because people live in awful conditions. People, I'm sure this weekend with this rain, mm-hmm. you know, hospitals are packed. And mm-hmm. if we were to just give people good living conditions, you know, so what they call the social determinants of health. So I think I didn't have the vocabulary then. I didn't have the knowledge, but I knew that something was wrong, that mm-hmm. the fact that a black female child born today in South Africa has half the life expectancy of a white female child was fundamentally wrong, that there were things that were happening structurally that were resulting in ill health that could be prevented. And I suppose my studies were to try and understand that a little bit better, but mm-hmm. also then how do I find my little corner to try and change some
yeah.
of that?
Yeah, that's really, yeah, that's a big task. It's a very big task. It's a very big ask as well, right?
Yes, yeah.
So I'm interested in this, the context within which a lot of healthcare providers work in South Africa, especially with regards to public health. Mm. And I'm putting you on the spot here. But I mean, if we haven't experienced public health ourselves, and I definitely have, then you've got relatives who still depend on it and experience it. And quite often the experience can be one that is either frustrating or humiliating, right? Or just really tiring because you're waiting.
Yeah,
you're getting spoken to and addressed in a certain way. You kind of have to twist yourself into pretzels and go into a pretzel and go, okay, so today I'm going to just say essentially yes, ma'am, no, ma'am.
Yeah.
So this thing can be over as soon as possible, you know. From your vantage point, what is happening there that turns, you know, people that essentially are there to help you and nurse you, or, you know, nurse you back to health or whatever it is, but one, a sort of job that one would think of as a calling and perhaps even a higher calling.
Yeah.
But clearly there's something wrong there. There's something that is not clicking into place.
No,
what's
sure.
happening there?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, how you've described it is as it is, regrettably. I mean, our health system is overstretched. I think the way it's been structured, these sort of two competing pillars, the private health system that pays healthcare workers significantly more than the public, means that majority of healthcare workers, specialists and professionals are in the private health system. So you've got a skeleton staff servicing the majority of the population. Mm-hmm. And that does result in burnout and poor practice. It doesn't make it right. But I think, again, we need to look at what is at the root. Because as you say, these are good people initially. They're kind of good apples that go into a rotten barrel. And that barrel does start to affect them. I mean, just amongst healthcare workers, the high levels of depression, alcoholism, you know, anxiety are increasing. And I mean, that's been reported widely. So they themselves are struggling. And so, you know, you can't pour out of an empty cup. And I think, so we need to look at fundamentally at the structure of a health system. Why is it that healthcare workers who really do want to do good for the most part are providing really poor services? And I think, you know, I don't want to open up a can of worms, NHI, but I think some of those policies are, at least if they are done properly, will bring us closer to a healthier health system.
Yeah. Mm. I guess the counter to that quite often is if we can't manage this right and get this right, what will a bigger public purse or in this instance do, you know, open us up to in terms of corruption or just mismanagement? So it's a scary prospect. It really is. And it begs deeper interrogation and consultation. But Kopano, I'm keen to find out, you know, you describe yourself on your own website as exactly that, as a mom. And I get a sense, we've spoken about this, that this is, you know, an important descriptor. But, you know, who are you when you're not being the novelist, when you're not someone who cares deeply about public health? And as we carry on our interview, we'll talk about Grow Great and this initiative that you've established against stunting, or to end stunting. Who are you, and what do? And what fascinates you and takes up your time?
I mean, I'm very much a homebody. I love to read. I do. I mean, when I say read, I don't mean like academically. I mean just to get lost in a novel. I'm reading one now called Sing Unburied Sing. I forget
Isn't
the name
of it. Isn't it beautiful?
Oh my goodness. It actually, like, Yeah, it's haunting me. I just think I don't even know how you write like that. It's an insane book.
So do you get writer's envy, right? Not even writer's envy, just that deep appreciation where you go, okay, I need to find out what, you know, synapses are sparking in that brain to make these kind of sentences appear on paper.
Absolutely. I mean, I mean, it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. Yeah. I often stop when I'm reading a book and I'm just so in awe that I'll like Google this person and look at them and be like, who are you? Like, how do you do this?
Jasmine Ward.
Yes,
that's the author.
Jasmine
I've just
Ward.
Looked it up. Yeah, it's an absolutely fascinating book. It's beautiful.
Yeah, so absolutely beautiful. So, I mean, that's what I enjoy. I enjoy long walks, enjoy a good cup of tea.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no, I mean, I'm very much a homebody. I like to be with my family. I like to be with my children. Mm-hmm. And I love to read.
Yeah. That's really, really fantastic. I did ask you, to give us two songs that you wanted to play or wanted us to play for you this morning. So between The Roots and Lauryn Hill, which one do you want to start with?
Lauryn Hill.
Okay. Tell me why you chose Tell Him.
You know, I actually struggle because I love all of Lauryn Hill's music. So I just kind of thought, well, let me quickly send what it is. So no, yes. I mean, it's beautiful. She's beautiful. She was sort of my muse as a teenager.
Yeah.
My hair, everything.
Well,
I modeled myself on her as a teenager.
The dreadlocks are definitely Lauryn Hill-esque. Am I gorgeous?
Yes. Yeah, no, I absolutely love Lauryn Hill.
Yeah.
I'm sad to not see so much of her now. I know she's got a new song out, but yeah, she's just, I've always just thought she was beautiful, creative, intelligent, and a gift to all of us.
A real inspiration. Let's hear it now. It's Lauryn Hill and Tell Him. I think that's taken off her debut solo album, right? Yeah. The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill.
Tell him. It's like, you know. Let me be patient, let me be kind, make me unselfish without being blind. Though I may suffer out in Vietnam and endure what comes, 'cause he's all that I got, and tell him, tell him I need.
And that's the music choice of Dr. Kopano Matla Mabaso. She's a South African medical doctor and novelist. Our profile interview today. We'll resume this conversation with her after the 8:30 headlines. But for now, let's do this.
Weekend Breakfast
with Refilwe Mpakanyane
on 702 for the curious.
It's 8:36 and my profile guest in studio is Dr. Kopano Matla Mabaso. She is the founder of the Zero Stunting Initiative, which we'll get into shortly. But she did recently win, she was honored at the 2019 Health Excellence as a Health Excellence Emerging Leader Awards. And, you know, I'm just so glad to have her in studio. She's a doctor. She's an author. She has done a lot of things. And earlier on, we were sort of debating. I try to call her philanthropist. Wrong adjective. We're still working on it. But Kopano, you are currently the executive director of Grow Great, that campaign that's aimed at mobilizing South Africa towards achieving a stunting-free generation by 2030. Mm. And you, I guess, alluded to that, which was getting to the source of the problem in public health, right? And that's your passion and that's your job and career. why did you decide to set your sights and focus on stunting?
So I was actually working for a philanthropy organization at the time, and it was recognized that, you know, we've done a lot in South Africa in terms of child survival, particularly around HIV, that our, you know, child deaths are not as high as they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But our kids are not thriving. So the World Bank has an index called the Human Capital Index and looks at the current generation and their future productivity.
Mm-hmm.
And we're about, children born today are about 41%, you know, in terms of their potential as they could be, mm-hmm, because of our education system, but also because of stunting. So stunting is being too short for your age from prolonged malnutrition and pregnancy in the early years of life.
Mm.
And increasingly, the literature and the science is showing that it's got long-term impact on brain development, on economic prospects, on your health. So it really does shortchange children, undermine their ability to fully reach their potential, even before they've had a chance to try.
Yeah.
So I think when I heard, so I mean, I was working for this organization and I was reading around this and just, yeah, completely felt, I was shocked myself that this was the case, and,
yeah,
and wanted to be part of the solution. And
yeah,
so a group of funders came together to back this initiative. It's exciting. We do a whole lot of stuff. We run mom and baby groups in communities. We do advocacy work. We work with healthcare workers. But it really is one, because I didn't know what stunting was. And
yeah,
I know many people, at least in my circles, don't. So one is to increase public awareness on the social injustice, but also to sort of drive commitments to really giving South Africa's children an ability to start life on an equal and fair footing.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, advocacy work is always such, and no matter the impetus behind it, the fact that you obviously not only do you mean well, but you're passionate around it as well. But measuring your impact, measuring the difference that you make can be quite a tricky one. So what metrics are you using?
Yeah.
How do you know that actually we have made a difference? And how big is your footprint as Grow Great?
No, that's a great question. So we're about 18 months old.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing now is actually just making sure that the recipe is correct. So we've looked at, so South Africa's stunting rates, which is 1 in 4 children, are much higher than you would expect for an upper middle income country like ours, but also much higher than our developing country counterparts. So Ghana, Senegal, Brazil, Mexico, Chile, all these countries.
So what is our problem?
You know, it's a tricky one. I mean, if you look at all the drivers of stunting, so anything from, okay, one, it's food, right? So you need to eat well, but also water and sanitation. It's one thing to eat well, but it's another thing to be, as a child, exposed to environments that are constantly giving you diarrhea, and even if you don't have diarrhea, but you've got low grade unhealthy guts, your body doesn't absorb those nutrients well. And we know that services are not what they should be. We know that from, you know, the schooling systems where children are falling into pit latrines. We know in many parts of the country, there's no piped water in homes.
Yeah.
Mental health is another thing. So moms who are struggling with depression antenatally and postnatally, birth outcomes are poorer. They struggle to breastfeed. They struggle to bond. We've got very high levels of antenatal and postnatal depression.
Mm-hmm.
Breastfeeding rates themselves are low. So there's all these things coming together at the individual child that are undermining their ability to thrive. When we look at Latin America, those countries have invested heavily in supporting women to breastfeed, have invested heavily in supporting women in pregnancy. One in four women in South Africa who are pregnant go hungry.
Mm-hmm.
60% of children live below the food poverty line. So it's all these things coming together that make children are surviving, but they're not at their optimum, you know? And
well,
I think
you alluded to the goal to make sure children thrive.
Yes,
so
exactly.
You know, that huge gap between survival and thriving, you know, you survive, but you just barely make it.
Absolutely. And the things that we've been doing to get children surviving are not the things that are going to get them to thrive. We need to reimagine, you know, what does the health system look like? How do we better enable and support? I mean, I was doing another interview the other day where the interviewer commented that if you go into Pick and Pay or Willys, you see that formula milk is locked up, right? So woman, you know, is actually like,
where?
In a lot of stores, I've actually taken pictures because this is now my obsession, right? And it's because, not because mothers are bad,
desperation?
But the desperation that women are stealing formula, that women are diluting it, mixing with mealy meal and all sorts of things. And of course, babies are not going to thrive, you know? But that women are going back to work very early, that maternity leave paid maternity leave is not legislated. Maternity leave is. That workplaces don't support breastfeeding. I recall myself, you know, coming back to the workplace and finding it very difficult and quite stigmatizing to be the one in a room, you know, with this pump going off. And that already is a privileged space to be in, that I have an office that I can use a pump.
Absolutely.
So there's lots of things. And I mean, it's also linked to these 16 days of, you know, where we're observing kind of, at least advocating against gender-based violence that women are up against a lot. And, and of course, you know, being a mother is part of a woman's identity. And so that suffers as well. That in fact, in pregnancy, women's risk of domestic violence goes up. Women's risk of HIV goes up because they become even more financially vulnerable than they've been in other times of their life. And so there's a lot of small anyana things that all come together that we need to be focusing on to ensure that our children grow well, grow great. And so that's what we're trying to pull together. And we are measuring that. I mean, we've got a very strong M&E team. We're looking, we're not trying to come up with new ideas. We're looking at the international literature. We're taking what works. We've seen that this has been done in other places. And so we're advocating for the same to be done here.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's, that is a comfort, knowing that you don't have to, you know, reinvent, or you don't have to start from scratch.
No.
You know, there's best practice that's worked elsewhere, and it's about staying the course, essentially.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
And 2030, what you said, the goal of 2030, why? Because that's just a chunk of time that makes sense, that's feasible.
Yeah, so aligned to the SDGs. So, in fact, reducing stunting is part of the Sustainable Development Goals. We've taken a little bit of a more ambitious take on it because I think we just don't, you know, I mean, sometimes what my frustration is just how we've normalized the high levels of inequality. We've become quite comfortable that we live in a country where a small proportion of people own most of the wealth, that, you know, we can live in our pockets of privilege and comfort, whilst the majority of the country are really living under dire circumstances. So our argument is we can't afford not to try reach these goals, but also we can't afford to waste time, that we are losing generations of South Africans because of our complacency and because we've normalized high levels of inequality and poverty, which we should be. There's just an absence of being alarmed enough about how difficult life is for many South Africans.
Mm. And maybe we're actually a lot fatigued.
Yes.
As I was discussing with Tamiri earlier on, if it's not a cause or a campaign, then it's just actually alarming occurrences and incidents,
you're right.
You know.
You're absolutely right.
We're in a very special and unique place, good or bad, but it really can feel a lot, a lot, as the kids would say. Now, you know, as part of your sort of focus, you've also been you've been elected to the board of Health Systems Global, and you're the founder of Transitions Foundations. Tell me about Transitions and what, you know, how that came about. But there's just really is a sense, once again, that you feel that there is no time for complacency and the work starts now.
Yeah. So, I mean, I started Transitions, goodness, almost a decade ago. Again, you know, I think as you grow and you know more and you have access to more, you do better.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I've always not been patient enough to wait. And so I've always tried to do what I can within my resources. So I started Transitions as an intern working in Galafong and Utrechtville. I had been selected for, it was some kind of fellowship when Michelle Obama was coming to Africa, and there was an opportunity to get funding. And I thought, you know what, I'm not going to miss this opportunity. What can I do where I am? And so there is an area very close to where I live where the school there was one of the worst performing schools in the district. And I know through my own upbringing that education is the thing that unlocks opportunity for many of us Black South Africans.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, brought in a group of young professionals, friends, volunteers, family members, and we basically provide after-school support to these young people. So it's maths and science tutoring, it's educational field trips, it's camps, you know, just giving young people an opportunity to come out of their setting. Where we can, we try and find job shadows. So it's been going now for over 10 years.
Yeah.
I'm chair of the board, so not as hands-on as I used to be, but it is sort of, you know, a small project that hopefully has impacted the lives of the kids where we work in that school.
Yeah.
But I think also it's just lay down the foundation for the next thing. I think, you know, if you look at REMS, it was very much like sort of, very unsophisticated. And then Transitions was a little bit better. We had proper funding and Grow Great is, you know, a proper organization. So I think it is just learning about development, not waiting until everything is in place and grant funding is in place, but trying to use the resources that I did have at the time to be part of the solution.
Yeah. So I guess in the language of startups, you've gone through many, many iterations, you know.
Absolutely.
You iterated and pivoted. And now here you are.
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
How easy or how difficult was it, now that you've established that you are this homebody, but how easy was it to, or difficult was it to not drink the Kool-Aid as far as being, a celebrity novelist, right? Because it's so nice to have the it girl on the scene. You go, oh, we're talking literature today. Who should we call? Kopano. She was featured in Glamour magazines, blah, 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 blah. Let's call her.
Yeah.
You know, if it was easy to not, you know, get caught up in the hype, how have you used it in, to your advantage, if at all?
Yeah. I mean, I must say the hype was lost on me. I don't know. I didn't know about the hype.
Kopano, please. We were seeing you everywhere, reading about you everywhere.
But anyway. But anyway, no, I mean, I think it's just also, I mean, I think it's been helpful to have another career, I suppose, where, I mean, as soon as Coconut came, well, as soon as I won that EU award, which is when Coconut got published, I had to be back at school, ward rounds, answering questions. So there was never an opportunity to kind of revel in all of that. In fact, my parents were like, you are going to fail. Like, if you don't focus on your school, what is this book thing? You know, they were just mortified that I was like even exploring something that was not school related. So I think I've just never had that luxury, I suppose. I think there's just been a lot of things going on. I absolutely love my medical career. And so that was, and in that world, I think nobody is giving you a lot of praise. You know, I mean, it's very seldom. I mean, medics are just kind of not, they don't celebrate each other. And so there was always a need to, particularly as a black student at UCT, which as everybody knows, is not a very transformed university, at least not at the time. Mm-hmm. So constantly, you know, having this massive imposter syndrome, trying to prove oneself, that I don't think I ever had that moment of like, oh my gosh, wow, I'm doing great in this aspect of my life. Yeah. But in terms of how I've used it, I think it's given me the confidence to trust our stories.
Yeah.
I think often, you know, we think they are better, bigger stories. And I think particularly with period pain specifically, it's kind of been received really well internationally.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, goodness, we have a lot to say. You know, we have a lot to share. We have a lot to say and to trust our voice. And so I think if how it translates into my other work is I am confident about my voice and my story.
So this is the Kool-Aid she didn't drink. In 2008 and 2009, Kopano was chosen as one of 300 young South Africans that, according to the Mail and Guardian, you must take to lunch. In 2011, you were selected as one of Glamour magazine's Women of the Year. And Kopano formed part of the founding group of the World Economic Forum Global Shapers Johannesburg Hub. And you were selected as a young physician leader by the Inter-Academies media panel in 2014. And you formed part of the 2015 class of the Dudu Fellows. And of course, you need this in your cap, one of the Aspen Institute's New Voices in Global Health Fellows. Yeah. Tell me about that experience at the Aspen Institute.
That was also, a really incredible opportunity. Pan-African group of incredible young people across disciplines. So working in tech, working in water and sanitation, working in global health.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible exposure. And so through that opportunity, I had an opportunity to pitch an idea that we had with a friend to improve maternal child health in rural Congo, which is also a crazy, audacious idea. And we won. I was like, oh my gosh, we won. We have to actually do this now. So we went out to Congo and set up a mobile clinic. And so it was an incredible opportunity. And I think all these things just kind of give you a little bit more courage to go for the next thing, to dream audacious dreams and goals. And to just belong to networks. I think, I think one thing I got out of Oxford, particularly the African community in Oxford, is goodness, how important it is to surround yourself with people who are doing things that scare you. Mm. And I think belonging to these fellowships and these networks has given me opportunity to never become complacent, sit on my laurels and say, oh, I've achieved a lot. Mm. But to always think there are people out there who are pushing boundaries for our continent, for the next generation. I'm doing good with the gifts that they've been given. And so that fellowship was the same.
Yeah. Really, really interesting. I think it's quite mind opening, or eye opening rather, maybe mind opening as well. To find yourself in that multidisciplinary, setting, and you finally realize or start to make very different connections about, you know, your number one, your own voice, and also the place in which your own specialty, can play or deserves, right? In a global setting of that state, of that nature.
And also, I think, you know, the South African exceptionalism that sometimes we have, right, on the continent, that sometimes as South Africans, we often think we sit separate or outside of or different to. And actually that, you know, that, yeah, I mean, I think for me, participating in these Pan-African groups, having, you know, opportunities to study with people from different contexts has made me realize that, you know, one can feel quite sorry for oneself about our history and our past, but actually suffering is everywhere in many forms in East Europe, in parts of Latin America, in parts of Asia. And it's about us as young South Africans deciding what kind of future we want and being that turning point generation, saying enough is enough, saying this is what we want for ourselves and actually doing that. Mm. And so I find it incredibly inspiring.
Yeah. Stepping into our agency. I'm just taking a look at SMSs here from Dr. Phil Mahuma in Midstream. He says, morning, Rufilwe and Dr. Mabaso. Thanks for a great discussion. I'm a family physician in public service and practice community-oriented primary care in the Tshwane district. I have great respect for the doctor's work, and I do my best in my space of influence. Best wishes. Thank you so much, Dr. Mahuma.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I mean, it's often quite a difficult one to have conversations about failures or systemic issues within public health without just knowing right there in the back of your mind that, you know, there are the Dr. Mahumas of this world who are working. Yeah. And who are doing their best in the system, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It really can be a difficult one. Here's one message that's pushing back a little bit, saying, hi, I love Kopano, but it always disturbs me when you talk about babies and children, don't mention their fathers as if they don't have any responsibility. But, you know, engaging the full, you know, or the whole family unit in a primary healthcare scenario looks like what? How often are fathers presenting with their partners or their spouses, I'm wondering?
No, I mean, I think that's such an important point, and one that we've been challenged with in our work is that, you know, I mean, it's been interesting. So we ran a radio series this year, and when we go to studios, you'll have a producer, someone from the team, ask us for a Road to Health book because they've got a baby at home, but the wife hasn't shared it. And sometimes as women, we kind of use this, these sort of privileges or whatever we want to think of to kind of, I guess, hold a space.
If I could ask you to get back on mic. Yeah.
Sorry, hold a space that we think is for women. And even the health system, I mean, technically, men can be with a woman when they're giving birth, but the nature of the way our health systems are structured, the wards, is that there are many women delivering in a space. There's no privacy, so bringing men into that space is tricky. So I think we also need to reimagine what it is about our health system that keeps fathers out, and also just the stereotypes that we have about men not wanting to be involved, and also that they're not, it's not just biological fathers, they are social fathers who play a huge roles in our upbringing. You know, who play a huge role in our upbringing. And I think there's a report, the State of Fatherhood report that the MRC released this year that speaks to that, that men can get child support grants, and that in fact, many men don't even read that even in the absence of a mother, even where a mother has passed, fathers are eligible to get the grant. So there's a lot of work we need to do there. Mm-hmm. We're certainly trying. So as I mentioned, we run these antenatal and postnatal classes where fathers are invited, partners, not necessarily fathers. We do a Grow Great Dads challenge every year where men are encouraged through radio to participate in a quiz based on early childhood development targeted only at fathers. But there needs to be more done because fathers, men are critical, and we don't engage them enough.
Yeah, and also we don't make these babies by ourselves.
No.
So of course you're important. Other half of this equation, for Pete's sake. But yeah, thank you for that very important message. Kopano, unfortunately, we chatted a little bit too long. I would love to try and force the issue and go ahead and play the Roots song, but we won't have time, unfortunately. Thank you so much for your time this morning and for giving so much and sharing of yourself. It's really been a pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So my next question, actually, before I let you go, is when are you setting up your own TV show? Because What listeners don't know is that off air, I was getting grilled and asked all the questions. And I was wondering, did I come for the interview? What's happening?
Oh, wow. No, I've got no plans to set up a TV show.
Oh,
but
come on. Just add one more thing
Who knows? Yeah, what the future might hold.
Yeah, we look forward to that to that TV show and that the talk show on air. You certainly got the dreadlocks on the face for it. We'll stick to radio for now. Dr. Kubanda Matla, Mabaso, thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
And we will hopefully be touching base with you sometime very, very soon.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All the best.